Hello everyone, this is Raghav. Before we get started with today's episode, we wanted to ask a super quick favor. In order to better understand and to serve our community, we are asking our listeners to fill out a super quick, anonymous, 5-minute survey. The link to that survey is bit.ly/SMOA survey. That's bit.ly/SMOA survey. We're really hoping this information can help us to do what we're already doing better. That's it. Thank you guys so much, and on to the show.
Welcome to Social Medicine On Air, a podcast where we explore the vibrant world of social medicine. We learn through conversations with healthcare practitioners, researchers, and activists who are working to create a more just and healthy world.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today on this next episode of Social Medicine On Air. We are a podcast that is committed to decolonizing medicine. And so our two guests today are two experts in that field. We have Raj Patel, who is an activist, filmmaker, academic. And I think I'm right in hearing that you were once in a corn costume when you two met.
That's right, yes.
You were also corn?
No, wait, no, you're right. It was protesting GMO corn, but I was, in fact, a tomato.
Oh,
tomato.
No. Those are entirely different. Yeah.
Yes.
And also, we're pleased to be joined by Rupa Maria as well, who's a physician, a musician, and the founder of the Do No Harm Coalition. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, friend.
And the occasion of this conversation is the work that you both have been doing on inflammation, on decolonizing medicine, on injustice, and a new book that's called Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice, which is an incredible read. It's a theory of everything, as far as I'm able to tell, and just a penetrating look into what is wrong and across multiple areas. I'm curious maybe to begin the conversation with you both by asking, is there a certain story or a certain experience that you have had, or even a certain pain and question that led to the need for this book?
I have so many from the bedside of so many patients where, you know, I just a few months ago saw a patient. I walked into a room. She was a middle-aged Black woman, lived in Bayview Hunters Point. And I looked at her, I'm like, she looks kind of familiar. And I'm sitting down and we're talking about her hospital course and she has cancer. And so we're talking about her treatments and complications and so forth. And then, I looked at her, I was like, wait, your name just sounds so familiar. And she's like, oh yeah, you helped my 26-year-old son die here of this aggressive lymphoma. And I remember him, I'll never forget him. I was like, oh my gosh. And the flood of memories came back. So he was, you know, a young Black man born and raised in Bayview Hunters Point. And he died of this highly aggressive lymphoma. And now his mother had cancer. And I looked at her, I was like, oh my God, how are you doing? And she said, you know, every single person on my block has gotten cancer. And, you know, the story of the Navy and the contractors falsifying the environmental data around Bayview Hunters Point, which is a site. So when the US was loading atom bombs to test out in the Pacific and bombing the Marshall Islands and that those atom bomb tests, those ships, after blasting the bombs and the radiation in the water, would come back to the port of San Francisco to Hunters Point. And these Black and brown workers would go to the shipyard and sandblast the ships. And all that sand and material is still in the soil. And there is radioactive material from experiments that they were doing there. In the community of Bayview Hunters Point, the Black folks, because it's a predominantly Black neighborhood, have been saying for years, like, we're getting cancer, we're getting sick, we're getting asthma, we're getting, you know, why do we have these rates? And then San Francisco would all say, oh, it's just the freeways that run through here. And it's just the this. And there used to be publicly data available on cancer rates by zip code. And then we were seeing that, you know, if you lived in Hunters Point in that zip code, you were getting really, really high rates of cancer compared to everyone else in San Francisco. But now that data is all aggregated and it's much harder to find, you know, what the cancer rates are for people. But you hear these stories like this, like everyone on my block has gotten cancer, that this woman buried her son and now she's struggling with cancer. And so it's stories like this where we realize that, you know, that the that the analysis we have in medicine is not enough. And that the analysis that the community members at Bayview Hunters Point, like Christopher Muhammad with Nation of Islam, like Dr. Ahimsa Sumchai, who's founded this Bayview Hunters Point community biomonitoring program, that these are the folks who know what's up in their community and they know why people are getting sick. And they've been shouting about it for 20 years and no one's listening. And so that feeling of, as a physician, the powerlessness of seeing that I could only help this woman get through this hospitalization, but I couldn't really help her heal. I couldn't really be involved in the transformation of her life because everything around her body was set up to make her sick. Mm-hmm. And whether it's the food deserts and the lack of food availability in Bayview Hunters Point, the police violence, Mario Woods shot by police, gunned down for holding a butter knife. And, you know, it's like there's so many layers of exposures that it's a miracle if you don't get cancer. It's a miracle if you don't get COPD and cardiovascular disease and diabetes. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we're seeing, is that the exposures, the sum of all the exposures over a lifetime, and even including your mothers and your great grandparents, is called your exposome. And that exposome, we're learning, Brendan, actually is more predictive of disease than even our genome, especially when it comes to chronic systemic inflammatory disease, which are all the major diseases we're dying from and that we treat as our bread and butter cases in internal medicine. And so those patient after patient after patient, I just felt like I could sit here all day. The demoralizing nature of that for myself as a physician to see that and realize that I can't actually improve this situation until I go way upstream. And when I'm working way upstream, I'm following the marching orders of those communities. And that has been a very powerful lesson. And it felt important, you know, when I knew Raj for many years. And I remember one of the first things he said to me when we met, we were at dinner at his house, is like, someone needs to write a book about, you know, capitalism and health and like the impact of capitalism on health. I remember he said this in passing on his way to the kitchen. He was making cheese souffles or something. He's a wonderful cook. And I remember thinking like, yeah, someone's really got to write that book. And then, so it was such a blessing to be able to meld our minds together and to really work with an expert in understanding the analysis of history and power, which is what Raj is just so good at, just so incisive, and to blend that with the understanding of bios, the biology and the body and the way we respond.
You know, I've been, and Ruby, you're too kind. I mean, you unlocked for me stories that I've been sitting on and been trusted with also for a while. I was in Japan soon after Fukushima, interviewing folk and talking to people, and found myself also in Okinawa, one of the blue zones, just doing some research on hunger and the sort of transformative possibilities of the social systems around longevity. And what was emerging there was that the longest lived people in the world were having shorter and shorter lives because of the imposition of US colonialism and the US base. And I managed to interview some of the people there whose prescription for this decline in longevity was to return land to them, to rematriate the land to the people of Okinawa from the people of Japan and the people of the United States. Okinawa has been colonized left, right, and center by China, by Japan, and then by the United States. And that idea of land rematriation just sort of sat there. And it took Rupa and her work and her medicine to really unlock what that story meant. And it was only in writing this book, nearly 10 years after first doing that reporting and research, that that story found its home. We've come with different kinds of experience, but it's only in this book that we managed to unlock for each other how to tell those stories in ways that help those stories land.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think you both touched on it as well, on for example, United States colonialism and militarism and the way that that has impacted health, both in California as well as in Okinawa. And I think I'm excited to get to that later in the conversation as well. But I also wanted to hear about this idea of the common path of inflammation and stress. This seems to be obviously the crux of the book, and that, and you notice in reading it very, very clearly how all of these various pathways from stress, racism, discrimination, adverse childhood events, imperialism are mediated through stress and inflammation. And when I was in medical school, what we learned about inflammation was mostly the kind of biochemistry of it. You know, you have acute phase reactants, you have certain proteins that go up when you're ill, when you have a viral infection, bacterial infection, you know, C-related protein, all these classic things that you learn about, but you never learn about the fact that CRP is directly correlated with poverty and being a member of a dominated class in a social system. That was never included as part of the curriculum. So I'm curious, why or what is the story behind inflammation that serves as like the linchpin of the argument in this book?
This is what I love to talk about, especially with medical student. So the amazing thing for me was finding the work of Polly Matzinger, who is this brilliant NIH scientist who was a Playboy bunny and a jazz musician and a carpenter, I believe. Didn't she have a stint as a carpenter? She's just done everything. Wow. And she became a scientist. And she has put forth an understanding of immunology and the immune system that has a far better explanatory power than the ones that we were taught still in medical school around recognizing self and other, which is coming from an Enlightenment era fallacy of thought, or that that somehow the self is separate from the other, or that there is a self and an other, or that there is a mind and a body as opposed to an integrated entity. And so Polly Matzinger, Dr. Matzinger, asserts that it isn't the immune system is not reacting to what's foreign. It's reacting to damage and the threat of damage. And so what I think we will learn is that the stress response and the inflammatory response are very closely related. They're using the same cytokines. They're using the same neuroimmunological and endocrine pathways. And they get activated. They activate each other. I feel like in a few years, we'll actually understand that these pathways are one and the same. So whatever causes damage will provoke this inflammatory response. And the inflammatory response is the way of the body actually resetting homeostasis. So there's been damage, either cells have, you know, set off their, the damage associated molecular proteins that signal a cascading pathway that leads to the release of IL-1 and CRP and IL-6. And then you get this, systemic inflammatory response. What we're learning is that it's not just the damage associated molecular proteins, signaling proteins, but it's also these SOS signaling proteins that are released under duress or stress or threat. So that psychological stress, and that comes with trauma, witnessing trauma, hearing the histories of trauma, being born to a mother who's being traumatized. These things are creating an inflammatory response in the body. And what happens, what we learn in medical school around wound healing. So you have inflammation, the body sends its recruits out to go get rid of the invading bacteria, and then everything's restored. And yeah, we lay down some fibroblasts, we stop we have the coagulation pathway, and everything kind of cools down and it turns off. You know, you have these resolvins, these other peptides that come in and turn off the response when the damage has been cleared, when it's been healed. So the inflammatory response is actually a healing response. But what happens when damage is in the exposome and it's constant and it's unmitigated, what happens then is the inflammatory response keeps going. And then you have bodies that are just chronically inflamed. And we're seeing, you know, all of these exposures, whether it's all the pesticides in our food and then the air pollution and then the lack of sleep because we're working the night shift or three jobs and then the stress of payday loans and then the police violence in our neighborhoods and the gun violence. So like all of these things end up priming the body for these SOS signals. And so this is not just theoretical or like, oh yeah, stress is real. Stress will kill you, but this is how it will kill you. It will kill you through imprinting itself on the immune system and tuning the immune system so it's ready to respond. And what happens when a mother is like that and then has a baby is that that baby's already born with that immune system primed and ready to go in that same way. So over the generations, this becomes an additive phenomenon. So is it a surprise that we see our indigenous communities whose land has been stolen and whose sovereignty in their lands has been forcibly erased? Is it a surprise then that several generations later, you're seeing everyone's got rheumatoid arthritis, everyone's got diabetes, you got cancer, you got all of these things. And so it is important to understand this because we won't be making any progress as doctors or healthcare workers if we're simply focused on the individuals. We have to start working at the level of society so that we can ensure people have the possibility of being healthy. Mm-hmm. We have to turn down inflammation from a societal perspective. And so I just want to conclude that this is not a new idea. So Virchow, who was in the 1840s, and who we think of, you know, in medicine as Virchow's triad and Virchow's node, and we didn't learn that he was a revolutionary. He was calling out German colonization of other parts of Europe and naming that that was what was driving typhus epidemics, not a bacteria. He recognized that it was the body's response to the bacteria that caused disease, and not the bacteria itself. And COVID is a excellent example of that. Why is COVID expressed differently in different people? And people like to say, oh, it's the genetics. But if you look at the people who are the most socially oppressed, those are the ones who are in there with severe COVID, and the children are there with the severe multi-inflammatory, multi-system inflammatory syndrome.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering, Raj, maybe you could connect that to the argument that you make in the book as well, around race and capitalism. Like how is what's happening in our bodies related to what's happening in the land, in history, in politics, in these larger social systems? And I love that line from Virchow that politics is nothing but medicine at a large scale. I think that brings both of these things together so well.
And, you know, I mean, I have to say, as someone obviously outside the world of medical education, I feel like I went to cytokine school in learning about some of these pathways. And that helped to complete the kinds of stories that one, you know, that I can see from the other side, from, you know, looking at sort of political ecology. And the thing that really unlocked it for me was something Rupert just said, which was that, you know, the immune system is ready to jump in at the threat of damage. And in order for something to be read by bodies as a threat, you need a story, you need a narrative, you need a social architecture. So, you know, if a man comes to your house and gives you a piece of paper, is that threatening? Well, you know, it depends on who you are and depends on what the man's doing. And it turns out that, you know, if the man is armed and evicting you from your home, and this piece of paper says that you've got to leave, and, you know, if you are a person of color and don't have many options, then all of a sudden, man giving you a piece of paper is absolutely a threat, and it can precipitate damage. And that sort of social situation in which what to one person could be, oh yeah, no, it's nice mailman coming to deliver something. In another circumstance, similar action, but different kind of social context, becomes the end of the possibilities of living in the house that you grew up in. So social context has everything to do with the way that our bodies come to learn about what is threatening and what is not. If you are a person of color, you know, if you're black in the United States, if you're British Asian and you know, and the police are there, that is a threat. And, you know, keeping one eye out for people in certain cars dressed in certain ways is part of what it is that you do when you're growing up as a way of self-defense. That already is, you know, the social context in which inflammation can chronically become a problem. And so, you know, Rupa mentioned payday loans. You know, and we've just gone through this crisis of evictions. We've managed to postpone it yet again. But unless we have a systemic fix, what we're going to see is, for example, payday loans flourishing. And payday loans, for folk who may be listening and don't know, are where, for example, you take out a loan of $200 and you have to pay back $500. And those extractive rates of interest are so so damaging, and the threat of having to repay and the threat of what one loses if one doesn't repay are so very real that if we were to ban payday loans, then one study calculated that the suicide rate would drop by 1.9% and the rate of fatal drug overdoses would drop by 8.9%. So we have a medical intervention, and that medical intervention is to ban payday loans if we're serious about, you know, the drug epidemic suicide rates. But this is precisely how it is that it's that the narratives of power and the police in particular coming to enforce these relations of property and relations of domination matter. And so it was very interesting to read the medical literature and spot how many times the police show up, right? You know, the in metaphors of the white blood cells, they're the friendly police. Well, you know, the police not so friendly depending on where you are and who you are. But the idea of policing boundaries and borders is not something that is innate to the body. It emerges from our colonial capitalist architecture of understanding meaning and boundaries and borders. If we stop understanding the immune system as the friendly police, but if we start understanding our bodies as learning to live with new beings, so we're not fighting something off, we're learning to live with, that shift in language helps us first identify where it is that we were going wrong, but also helps us, you know, be a bit more open to a wider world of life of which we know very little at the moment.
And what is what is it about racial capitalism that's so key to this picture? And what is the way in which capitalism is driving inflammation? I think of a story as well. I was recently up and able to be a guest in northern Minnesota where the Line 3 protests are happening under Indigenous leadership against Enbridge and extractive fossil fuel industries. It was an extremely powerful experience to be there. Folks were camped out on the Mississippi River defending treaty rights, 1855 treaty rights of the indigenous people who have been there against Enbridge and the private security that have been involved as well. And they were drilling the day that we were up there with a group of healthcare workers with Health Professions for a Healthy Climate. They were drilling under the Mississippi. And that very day, there was a frack out where the fracking fluid entered into the Mississippi. And this is right at the headwaters where the Mississippi is about 5 feet wide. And it was an extremely interesting and tragic and grief-filled moment of seeing the connections for me in my own backyard and in the place where I grew up, where I feel loyal to, of the connection between the need for capital to grow and to expand and to make money and to make new pipelines and to continue to extract and to have no limits on its growth, and tying very directly to the questions of race and indigeneity in northern Minnesota versus otherwise white populations surrounding it, and the ways that that exacerbated kind of the conflicts between race and class. And of course, it's all centered around the land, and it's all centered around who has the land, what is being done with the land, what are the relationships of domination or of cooperation that exist there?
Yeah, the word stakeholder drives me crazy because we don't uplift Nazi German culture the way we uplift the white dominant culture here in the United States, but the Nazis, so Hitler was studying what the United States did to its indigenous people when he came up with his ideas for what to do with the Jewish problem. you know? And so we look with abhorrence at the Nazis and how horribly they treated those Jewish people. And man, we should return that art and we should, you know, make amends. We should have a museum. We should have, national recognition about what has happened. And here, if you teach, you know, any sort of history about the genocide of Indigenous people and the way their lands were stolen and the way their relationships were completely obliterated, to continue their culture of caring for the lands that they have been on for thousands of years and have been on in a way that supported the ecological biodiversity and health and vitality of those lands, which have in every place that Western colonial capitalist expansion has happened in Indigenous lands has destroyed. So here in the Bay Area, I'm speaking to you from occupied, unceded Ohlone territory, Checheno Ohlone territory. And the water is poisoned and the air is toxic and the mountain lions are run off into the hills. The grizzly bears are gone. The coyotes are gone. The salmon are gone. So they aren't gone by, this is just a product of people being here. No, because people were here for tens of thousands of years and vital relationships. They're gone because of the cosmology that came with colonial capitalist expansion. And it's a cosmology based on these enlightenment errors, that there is a self and an other, that there is a nature and a civilization, that there is the environment and then you. That there's these separations of us from the web of life upon which our entire health is dependent, you know? And if we look at microbiome science, that's just hammering that home. Like, we are not healthy with a biodiversity of beautiful little critters inside of us that come through tending our environments and our foods in ecologically wise ways. And so it is a direct outcome of capitalism and specifically race-based capitalism, because the project that happened here in the United States was a project of racial domination. It was a project of eugenics. It was a project of eliminating an entire group of people and eliminating their culture. So the boarding schools that we're hearing about in the news was all about force feeding Western ideas and concepts and language, ripping it out of the tongues of the children, literally. And that violence is a part of the history of this land. So when we look at line 3 and see what's happening right there, and I was there during the medical response to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and we see the violence of the rubber bullets on the bodies of Indigenous people, and we see that these are hired mercenaries and police, it becomes very clear what this project is about. It is about the domination of different kinds of peoples and lands and waters to serve the interests of an elite, a global elite of corporations that are destroying the earth. And they're destroying the earth because of that cosmology. Because if you really felt a relationship to the water, and that was the most important thing, to protect the health of that water for all the generations, then not just yourself, but everyone that comes beyond you, then you wouldn't do these things. And cultures that understand that haven't done these things. And those people are living with lower rates of systemic inflammation. And so it's not that we're saying we have to go back and pine for the good old days when everyone was living in huts and, you know, running around in loincloths. That's not what we're saying. But we're saying there is a knowledge system. There are knowledge systems and sciences and ways of knowing and ways of being that are much more sophisticated than Western civilization has offered with this brutality, that lead to better health outcomes for people and for ecosystems. And so let's start being more humble and learning from them. Let's start learning. And so that is, you know, if we talk about being a lifelong learner in medicine, this is a great time to start learning what decolonizing medicine is all about. Because these same structures of violence we see with line 3, we see them in the hospital. We see Black patients' pain ignored. We see Black mothers dying at 12 times the rate as white mothers in New York City. We see Black babies dying under non-Black care. Like, these aren't just magical things that happen. These are from the same cosmologies of organizing a hierarchy to life that is unhealthy.
You know, and how ironic that it's the Mississippi the current battle is. Where the current battle is being waged, of course, you know, the Mississippi, as I'm sure your listeners will know, was the dividing line in the Trail of Tears, where lands to the east were exchanged for lands to the west. And that's why Hitler said that, you know, studying US history, he hoped that the Volga would be the Nazis' Mississippi. Right, this idea of ethnic cleansing was central to the ideas of Nazi domination, but it, you know, also central was the idea that Nazis, like capitalists, wanted certain kinds of things to be put to work and worked to death. Whether that was the Jews, whether that was the land, whether that was certain kinds of species, whether that was other things in the web of life. And that's why the hierarchy of this cosmology matters, right? Because capitalism puts things to work until they die. And that, I think, is important to remember, because we live with those legacies. That's why, for example, enslaved people and their descendants in the United States are still not protected in their work in the same way. For example, the kinds of professions in which, people of color are overrepresented are things like in the food system, which has been spared the privilege of unionizing. And so you've got large parts of the food system where either workers are being paid the minimum wage, the tip minimum wage, I think it's still $2.14 an hour. And then on top of that, this sort of white supremacist idea of tipping prevails, in which one must supplicate to the wealthier white people to win their approval for service and servitude. And those kinds of operations of power and domination are necessary for capitalism to carry on with the kinds of the way that it would like to, and that, I think, again, I mean, it gets back to Rupert's point that it can stop doing that when we start caring and insisting on care as a mode of operating rather than domination, and that means organizing. You know, we talk in the book about how no one is safe until everyone's safe, and that's strikingly similar to the union line: an injury to one is an injury to all. And that, you know, the idea that we need to move away from the sort of individual, like, I'm going to be the best doctor ever, and recognize that, in fact, decolonizing is a social process, is something that, again, we learn from elders like Frantz Fanon, who, as an active opponent of colonialism, first tried successfully to decolonize his psychiatric practice before realizing that there are limits to that, because, you know, under a settler state, there's only so much you can do. And in fact, what needs to happen is liberation as part of the practice of decolonizing medicine.
I was wondering if you guys could expand a little bit as well on this idea of the Enlightenment cosmology and the way that this funds a lot of our science, the way that it funds our politics, the way that it funds our relationships with one another. That's something that I have only come to myself understand more in recent years. I think it's so much part of the water and the cultures that many of us have grown up in, the idea that there is just an individual and I'm an individual that's separate from you, and each of us have our own little kingdoms, and that extends to little families, which are each kingdoms, and nation states, which are little kingdoms, and each of them are separate and antagonistic in relationship with one another. Could you say more about the foundations of those ideas and the ways in which those have been destructive? And what are the relationships that need to come after that? Or what are the relationships that point towards a future of care, and how those are already being seeded in the moments and practices of care that we find around us?
Well, can I just jump in to observe, Brendan, that that's a lot of kings for the kingdoms that you've outlined.
Part of the problem.
That is part of the problem. So I didn't want to cut you off, but I did want to sort of point out that that this idea of patriarchy looking the way that it does is part of this sort of original sin of the colonial cosmology that's really birthed through 1492, you know, the invasion of the Western Hemisphere and the ethnic cleansing of Iberia that happened at the same time. And really, you know, it's centered around this idea of society on the one hand and nature on the other. And these are terms that while you know, mixed at the beginning of the last millennium start to tease apart so that all of a sudden you have a world in which society can dominate nature. And the policing of who counts as being able to be part of society is, you know, in some ways the history of the past 1,000 years, where originally it was only white-propertied Catholic men who were part of society. And then gradually the doors of membership to society were opened, but not entirely and still not yet. And that's, you know, that means that there's a wealth of things that one can exercise dominion and power over, and you know, treat as subjects in a kingdom. But again, this language of kingdoms. And, you know, I grew up in the United Kingdom. I am allegedly a subject of Her Majesty the Queen, and I want to bring my most stern social science here, but she can go fuck herself. Because I have no time for the monarchy. I think it's, you know, it's a sign of the deep kinds of oppression with which we still are surrounded. But Rupert, sorry, he said my unsafe word. He said king, and I had to just go after the queen because, you know,
yes, go after queen. Those queens. Yeah, so look at what's happening right now with COVID, right? We have this surge that's surging harder and faster than any time in the pandemic, and all we're being told is to go get a vaccine. So this, while knowing that the vaccine doesn't prevent us from carrying as much COVID in our nose if we happen to get infected as someone who's unvaccinated. And for all the children under 12, what does that do for them? Where does that leave them? So the lack of ability to think systemically, like through systems, how do we keep everybody safe as this variant we don't actually know very much about because it came from India, where another authoritarian, you know, idiot has been in charge. And so that public health data was not available. We don't know how it spreads. We don't know how many bodies were floating down the Ganges River. We just know that I lost a whole ton of relatives, gone. So how do we act in the face of that knowledge? Oh, we just tell everyone to get another shot. You know, just get more shots, get more shots. We don't ever start to say, let's give everyone a universal basic income. Let's make sure, let's just cancel rent and mortgages. Let's just reinvent housing with a benefit on the public good so that no one loses their house. Let's make sure we can offer everyone who's unhoused a safe place to be. Let's expand healthcare to everybody right now. So if anyone's got the virus, they can come in and make sure they get treated because there is treatment for this. For this illness now. We're getting better at treating it all the time. But we don't talk about that. We don't talk about the, you know, the systems level. We just keep hoping that everyone just puts a mask on and gets a vaccine and gets another vaccine, get the kids in school so all the working class can go back to work and keep the economy going. Mm-hmm. And that is not enough. And we're going to see it. You know, now we're starting to see, I just saw a friend just posted that an 11-month-old is having seizures and from COVID. So now we're seeing like babies. That's what's coming next. And that to me is shows the kind of grim reality of cultures that are obsessed with economic endpoints rather than human safety. And with what's coming with climate change, this is just the tip of the violence. And so for myself, I say, let's start structuring those policies now. Let's start rewiring ourselves now so that we do not continue the violent act of looking away at unhoused folks, as my formerly unhoused friend, Tiny Gray Garcia says, so that we start to reach out and say, how can I help? And how can we make this better? Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, this is where you also see the limits of medicine and academic medicine. People talking about race and society. And, you know, we can analyze till the cows come home the disparities, but we don't hear academic medicine say, therefore, let's dismantle the capitalist economy. Let's actually remove the engine from the suffering. Mm-hmm. And just reorganize the resources to keep everybody safe. And then we'll see how we all feel with that. Maybe we like it better. Maybe we don't, you know, need to go work 40 hours a week. Maybe we could spend that time with our families. Maybe we've generated enough wealth, we can tax it and get it back for the common good. And so that, you know, it's a really interesting moment to ask these questions, because those kinds of systems level analysis are antithetical to Enlightenment thinking. It's not just the reductionist view of like this one thing, you just need this one vaccine and this one T cell response and we'll be fine. It's like, no, that's not it. That's still not it. And you see these, you know, pundits, these doctors, some of them at my own institution, who are, you know, just pushing that agenda. And I'm very much in support of people getting vaccinated. I know it works to help reduce the severity of infections and the hospitalizations. However, we don't have a society where everyone feels safe accessing healthcare. So I went on a walk this morning with a friend who's Kickapoo from Kickapoo Nation. And she's like, my sister had cancer for months before she went to the doctor, because Indigenous folks in her community don't feel safe going to the doctor. Same with undocumented people, don't feel safe. So how do you invite those people to come get a shot when there's been a historic breach of trust? And while the major problem has been access, the trust is also a really important thing to consider, because it's those people who don't get vaccinated who will become, you know, who will suffer the hardest hits. So I think that looking at medicine purely as a biological experience or a, you know, that reductionist viewpoint is insufficient to managing the systems level failures we're seeing right now with climate collapse and pandemic. And so what we're seeing and what's so great about microbiome science, it's demanding that we understand, if I don't have my microbiota, I am sick. So are those microbiota me or are they other? What are they? So if I include my microbiota, what am I? Am I a composite organism? How do they factor into my happiness and sadness? And they do. My moods are influenced by these creatures I cannot even see. You know, so there's a beauty and a mystery in our lives, in the ways in which we are hopelessly interconnected. And so how can we start to turn our attention to that and start to develop our science through that? I feel like it's our ecologists and our microbiologists who are really going to lead our science in the direction of wisdoms that have been known for thousands of years.
Beautiful. That gives me pause just hearing all of that and want to soak it all in. It hopelessly interconnected. And the porosity of our relationships and our boundaries between one another can be used, obviously, for domination and can also be the sources of creativity and new life. And I think we see that as well in the way that borders can either be militarized or they can be, as in, you know, the meeting between the ocean and the land, and can be a space of new life. And those are the places with the greatest biodiversity that we know. And I think, yeah, I just am sitting with that thought of the porosity of our boundaries and the interconnections. One of my memories that comes to mind, another example kind of pulled from the Midwest here. I was on a road trip a number of years ago with my brother, and we were driving through rural Iowa. And of course, it's just monoculture cornfields, right? And every once in a while, you drive through town and there are fast food restaurants and a subway, all this. But the biggest buildings that we saw for a number of miles that I kept noticing were these dialysis centers. And just realizing, like, why are there so many dialysis centers in rural Iowa right now? And of course, that's directly connected to what exactly was coming out of the ground right next to the dialysis center. and the ways in which corn and high fructose corn syrup and the ways in which those cause diabetes and eventually kidney failure, and all of that ecosystem is entirely connected. And then people in the land all are deeply interconnected in the ways in which the monoculture of the earth is also reproduced in the monoculture of our microbiome and the ways in which that ties into inflammation.
Yeah, and what I was surprised to learn in the book was that the aging of immune cells, when they're subjected to damage, they end up acquiring not just regular cellular senescence, where they just go quiet and they get taken out of circulation. They acquire this senescence-associated secretory phenotype, SASP. You should look it up because it blew my mind. I didn't know anything about it until I started researching this book. But senescence-associated secretory phenotype, that of aged cells that have been damaged or exposed to chronic damage and stress, end up being super factories of pro-inflammatory cytokines. And they drive systemic inflammation. And they are now being found in chronic kidney disease and in the brain with Alzheimer's disease, in cardiovascular system. And so I think we will come to learn that this damage that we're talking about is a part of the pathways of why is everyone now on dialysis? Why does everyone have diabetes? And yes, the food system is extremely important because the damage is coming that way too, as you're saying, with these high fructose corn syrup, these dietary chemicals, these processed foods that our body has no way of recognizing. The microbiome just doesn't have a chance to digest them. So we're not feeding our forest in the right way, our internal forest. So it's not doing the work that it needs to do for us. And Brandon, the most powerful ally we have in fighting systemic inflammation is the gut microbiome, is the microbiota. So if they're not being fed properly, they're going to die, they're going to lose their biodiversity, and they can actually start creating byproducts that harm us. And so this is extremely important because what drives profit for, you know, one agribusiness company is causing disease for millions of people around the world. And that's not okay.
And yeah, I mean, yeah, and Rupa's exactly right. I mean, it's easy to imagine now Nestle, for example, coming in and just saying, yes, you know, we're going to add new probiotics to our existing line of food and therefore make them healthy. And it was an embarrassing report that came out a couple of weeks ago where 60% of Nestle's food, it turns out, failed a basic definition of being healthy. And 98% of their non-water, non-coffee beverages also unhealthy. And you know, the way that the food industry would address that is just by sprinkling vitamins or adding extra probiotics in and it'll be fine. But the food industry itself is an engine for making other people pay for its profits. You know, there was a statistic recently where it emerges that Americans spend about $1.1 trillion a year on food, but the food industry causes $2.3 trillion worth of damage, most of that through the healthcare consequences of consuming what it is that the food industry does, makes rather. And then, of course, you know, to Rupa's point about the microbiome, I mean, you know, if we are holobionts, if we are these assemblages of living beings, then actually taking ancient ancestral fauna and eating it is not going to be good enough, because unless the surrounding ecology, the ecology that supports the holobiont is itself teeming with life, then we'll constantly need to replenish in our gut these beings that otherwise would survive in healthy relationship inside and outside our bodies. So, this gets back to your point, Brendan, that if we follow the sort of individualist track, or even if we follow the colonial medical track of saying, yes, fine, we are holobionts, we just need to supplement, and with more webs of life inside us, everything's going to be fine, and drawing the boundary at our body, and then everything outside can perish, and the sixth extinction outside our body can go ahead just fine. Inside our body, we'll have reversed the sixth extinction. That's not a tenable way of understanding how ecology works or how the web of life works. And so the only way that we have a teeming internal biome is by having a teeming external one. And that and since the forces of capitalism are geared towards making profit out of the destruction of that external biome, then there's only one way to ensure that we have a teeming internal biome, and that's the destruction of capitalism.
That was well said, Dr. Patel. I'm so glad it was recorded. Yeah, and it's funny because there's this great microbiome researcher, Sonnenberg from Stanford, who just released this wonderful paper showing that, you know, you eat 10 weeks of fermented foods and you've increased your gut biodiversity and you decrease 19 different levels of markers of inflammation. So exciting. This same person is now trying to push rewilding the gut by getting feces from indigenous people and selling them. And we put a line in the book as a joke. We're like, somewhere out there, there's a capitalist looking to turn indigenous shit into gold. And it's happening. Wow. There was a New York Times story about it. And Dr. Kealu Fox, a Kanaka Maoli scientist down at UCSD, indigenous scientist who's putting together this group called the Indigenous Futures Lab down there, of people who want to protect the genetic resources that are indigenous people. Because folks who are living with their cultures intact and unmutated through capitalist exploitation have a biodiversity we don't have. The most biodiverse gets on earth are these Hadza people, these indigenous people, Yanomami in the Amazon. The least biodiverse gets on earth are the US urban dwellers. So the proof is in the pudding, you know, and it's not something that we can just take a pill and hope things get better, because we have to fundamentally alter our relationships. The microbiome of Hadza hunter-gatherers are a living reflection of all of their relationships with the world around them. It's not something that is just popped. And so that is really the crux, I think, of the argument that we are making, is that if capitalism has fractured and severed these critical relationships we've had with the web of life and with each other, what we must do to lower inflammation is to restore those relationships. And those relationships cannot be restored under a capitalist system. Therefore, we must abolish that system. And that means to create new economies that are driven through care of one another and care of the earth.
And that's why it's so important that the answer or the response that you give to stress and to inflammation is not to calm down, right? It is to decolonize. It is abolition of capitalism. It is the move. It is organizing. It is fighting the powers of death and destruction and moving towards the web of life and interconnection and the holobiont without and within.
Yes, and I think that it is important to exercise care of ourselves and our communities. So it is important to do that meditation.
Yes.
And to eat well and to not just absorb the stress and outrage for our pipeline resistors, our frontline warriors. A lot of work I do is just helping to reintegrate and to take care because we need them to be healthy. And simultaneously, it's to activate what you said exactly. Yeah.
Can you? Wonderful.
Listeners will have heard children in the background. And yes, Rupert and I are parents with children who are, in my case, ready to go to bed. I've been muting them. It is time.
It is time.
Well, thank you so much. It sounds like you'll both be practicing cultures of care in your own home, sending your kids to bed, so living embodiment. Thank you both so much for being guests on Social Medicine on Air. It's a treasure of a book and one that I will be excited to share with others, and one that I would encourage all of our listeners to get their hands on one way or another. It is an incredible work of scholarship and also just a reflection of your activism and passion. And thank you so much for your time and expertise and wisdom and care.
Thanks so much, Brendan, for reading
In
Flames.
Thank you, Brendan.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
This is Social Medicine on Air, co-hosted and produced by our team. Jonas Adelis, Sebastian Fonseca, Raghav Goyal, Brendan Johnson, Leila Saba, and Poetry Thomas. Intro, outro, and incidental music credits go to Smith the Mister. Huge thanks to Dr. Marwa Salah for feedback and advice, and to Clara Brand for designing our logo. If you haven't already, please, please leave us a review and give us some stars wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us to keep going. And if you would like to share your story on the podcast or have any thoughts, questions, feedback at all, please reach out to us by email at socialmedicineonair@gmail.com or on Twitter at socialmedonair. We would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening.